From NPR Music, you're connected to All Songs Considered. I'm Bob Boylan. We all have our musical heroes, those musicians that are game-changing, sometimes life-changing. Musical heroes are often people that we admire for their attitudes, their approaches to life, as much as their music. And of course, because of those approaches to life, that's often the reason we love their music. Brian Eno is my musical hero. From his treatments to the sound of Roxy Music as a bandmate, to his solo albums, both pop and ambient, to his creative approach to using tape loops, to his inspiring production, and these days, to his self-generating and interactive music apps like Bloom or Trope and Air, Brian Eno continues to inspire. Eno has a new record coming out. It's called Drums Between the Bells. We'll talk about that record. But we've asked him to play other people's songs for us, music that he's passionate about today, and music that meant something to him as a child. On this edition of All Songs Considered, Eno plays DJ. I kicked off the conversation by asking him about his first musical memory.
It would be very hard for me to remember my very earliest memories because my father and my grandfather, and in fact both my uncles, were very keen on music, so there was a lot of music around. But the first thing I can remember really being completely captured by was a song by the Silhouettes called Get a Job, which I think came out in 1956, possibly, or 57, perhaps, I'm not quite sure. But it was the first doo-wop song I'd ever heard, and I absolutely loved it.
Dip 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 dip. Sha la la la, sha la la la, ba do. Sha la la la, sha la la la, ba do. Sha la la la, sha la la la, ba do. Sha la la la, sha la la la, ba do. Dip 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 dip. Boom 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 boom, get a job. Sha la la la, sha la la la, ba do. You raise me money to buy this time to get me out of my bed of crying, get a job. Sha la la la, sha la la la, you wrap to breakfast every day, you know the warnings on my way.
Me.
I then go back to the house, hear that woman's mouth
reaching and crying, tell me that I'm lying about a job that I never could find.
I thought, I didn't know where it came from. I had no reference point for music like that.
You were living where, and you were probably 8, 9 years old or so?
If it was 1956, I would have been 8 years old, yes. I was born in 1948. I was living in Suffolk, which is one of the quieter counties of England, not far from the sea, a very rural area. But in fact, there were three large air bases within about 5 miles of the town. Two of them were American air bases. So we had within really walking distance of this small town that I grew up in, there were 17,000 Americans. As a result of this being the only place they had to go outside of the base, it had dozens of coffee bars. Coffee bars were the thing of the 50s. And each coffee bar had a jukebox, and each jukebox had the most amazing music on it because it was the music that the Americans wanted to hear. You know, a lot of it was Southern R&B and blues and sort of gospelish stuff. Nothing like anything I heard on the radio.
What was the popular music at that time where you were? Because I know what it was here.
Well, it was terrible. It was absolutely awful. And the worst part about it was that often when something was a hit in America, you'd have some great black singer from Southern singer doing a great song like, I don't know, If You Gotta Make a Fool of Somebody, which came out by James Ray originally in an incredible form. It had a tuba playing the bass part and so on. But the English version of that was covered by an English, actually a Merseybeat group called Freddie and the Dreamers. And it was kind of a joke song by comparison. So this was always the transition, that it would go from this kind of heavy, dirty, sexy black sound to the prettied up vanilla English version. And so I would hear both of these because I was hearing the English one on the radio. And I have to say, I always preferred the dirty version.
Can you figure your attraction, what it might have been? I mean, and now it's retrospect, but...
I think partly it was just the strangeness of it. I've always liked exotic things. And, of course, I didn't know at that time what the source of this music was. I didn't even know for many, many years that everybody I was listening to was black. I just didn't know. I hadn't seen photographs of anybody. You know, no English magazine or newspaper would carry a picture of James Ray. Or after a little while, I realized that Little Richard was a black man, but he was the exception. You know, I just didn't have any visual reference for most of the people I was listening to. It was a eureka moment for me of suddenly finding out where all this music that I loved so much had come from. I realized it came out of churches. You know, if you listen to the gospel, particularly of the 30s and 40s, you suddenly think, oh, that's how doo-wop started. That was where they got it from. It was a big breakthrough for me.
And you saw the stone that was hewed out in mountain, yes, and you saw the stone came rolling through Babylon, and you saw the stone that was hewed out in mountain, and he joined that heavenly bird. And you saw the stone that was hewed out in mountain, yes, and you saw the stone came rolling through Babylon, and you saw the stone that was hewed out in mountain, and he joined that heavenly bird. Little David caught the stone that was hewed out in mountain. Little David caught the stone, came rolling through Babylon. David caught the stone that was hewed out in mountain, and he joined that heavenly bird. King Jesus caught the stone that was hewed out in mountain. King Jesus caught the stone.
This is one of those songs that came out of the sort of quartet movement that seems to have all started in one town, Norfolk, Virginia. That's where the Golden Gate Quartet came from, and the Silver Leaf Quartet, I think, were from there as well. So there was this sort of little explosion of interest in this very particular form of singing, which I think relied a lot on microphones, because the bass singers in this style generally sing very quietly. I saw a picture once of the Golden Gate Quartet recording, and the bass singer was standing about 8 inches from the mic, and the rest of the singers were about 4 feet away. So to get that soft, deep bass, you have to have a microphone, really. So I think, apart from being a music that, of course, grows out of the whole tradition of African call and response music meeting Gaelic, Scottish, English music somewhere in the middle of America, you also have this other thing of it being a technologically determined music.
Out the mountain, and she joined that heavenly bird. Yes, I want that stone that was hewed out the mountain. Yes, I want that stone came rolling through Babylon.
Do you find that what you loved so much about music from that period, gathered around a microphone, comes into the what you do now? I mean, in some ways, anybody who just came to some of your music would say, gosh, Brian, your music's sort of the polar opposite of that.
Well, yes, I suppose it is, actually, in some ways. Though what you choose to do isn't necessarily the same as what energizes you in the first place. You do what you can, you know, mm-hmm. and that's only one of the things that has energized me. So what I finally end up doing is a kind of collage of that with lots of other things. By the way, do you think the audience will be fed up that we're fading these out and I'm nattering on over the top of them?
So the audience knows, and I'll just tell you, that we put full versions of the songs online so people can hear them in the clear. And this way we can have a conversation with sort of a natural flow to it.
Good idea. So the attraction of this music for me was, first of all, that it's a very interesting social group that makes that kind of music. You know, if you've ever tried a cappella singing yourself, the main objective is to kind of disappear. It's sort of the opposite of rock music in a way, in that it's to do with egolessness in a certain
sense. So it's
the power
of the group is what you're saying. You are, you know, one small cog in a very big, wonderful wheel.
Yes, and the lovely thing is that when suddenly the whole thing gels together, it's you're much, much more and much less than you thought you would be at the same time. Because when you're singing a cappella like that, you really have to harmonize in three different ways. You have to be in tune. That means to say you choose the right notes. You have to be in time, and that's very important, particularly in this kind of gospel singing, which is all to do with a sort of syncopated rhythmic singing. And you have to be in tone as well. So your timbre has to be right. And hitting all of those three together is very ecstatic, I think.
You do a singing group. I think it was maybe Joe Boyd who told me he does some of that with you at times.
Yes, that's right.
Tell me about that.
It's, in fact, every Tuesday evening. In fact, as soon as I finish this, I'm going back to my studio to meet the singers who will no doubt be waiting outside the door. It's a singing group that has two ironclad rules, which is that we never record and we never perform. So it's done entirely for the pleasure of doing it, with no danger of anyone saying, now we've got to get really good at this because we're going to make a record. We don't record anything. So the group is a very peculiar cross-section of people who would probably never be in the same room otherwise. There's lawyers, an editor, a writer, a boxer, an actress, a baroness, actually, who's in the House of Lords. Just a very peculiar group. There are altogether about 24 people on the list, and usually about 8 to 12 of them will turn up.
And is the repertoire gospel? Is the repertoire anything? Folk music?
The repertoire is songs that people basically know. and awesome. Also songs that are easy to harmonize. So there are a lot of songs that people know which are very, very hard to harmonize. For instance, take the song Summertime. Everyone knows how to sing the melody of it, but harmonizing it is quite hard. Mm-hmm. If you're harmonizing spontaneously, we don't work from scores or anything like that. Some of them are gospel songs, like we do Will the Circle Be Unbroken. Then there's some sort of folk gospel, Down by the Riverside. Then there's a couple of Percy Sledge songs. There's a Shirelle song. There's Do-Do Ron Ron. But essentially, the main thing is to find music where people who aren't necessarily trained singers and who aren't reading from a score can still harmonize interestingly and find a place for themselves in the music.
Can I play something that's sort of in something that you picked? This is not far from what we're talking about. This is a song I've never heard before, and it seems like I should have. Let me just play it. Tell me about this song, Brian Eno.
Isn't that such a charming song?
It is a fantastic song.
And by the best-named group of all time, Reparata and the Delrons. That's a fabulous name, isn't
who
it?
Who were they? And yeah, what is that name?
I've never heard of anyone else called Reparata. And I don't know what it
but
means.
But it's very musical.
Does it come from reparations? You know,
no.
It's a funny thing to name your child after reparations. Reparator and the Delrons. I can't remember when this came out, but I think it was.
It has to be 61 or so,
early
right?
60s. Yeah. Yes, and I, again, it was one of those pieces of music that appeared. I had absolutely no idea how anybody could have arrived at something like that. All that kind of interesting atmospheric stuff at the beginning with ships and bells ringing and so on. And in fact, it sort of alerted me to something that became a theme really for me, which is that everything behind the voices is interesting as well. You know, the thing about recording studios and was that people had started to realize that when you made a piece of music, you were really building a scene of some kind. You were inventing a sort of virtual new acoustic space. Of course, that's what Phil Spector went on to do so famously. But this record is an early example of that, of someone saying, hey, it's a record. It doesn't have to be anything like a performance. We don't have to have the image of people standing in front of microphones doing things. We can just imagine that we're in a different place.
Mm-hmm.
And that idea of using music as a way of creating different places became very important to me.
Can I play something really quick? This is it just made me think of this when I just heard this, and that song, that group came out of Brooklyn probably 50 years ago, and 50 years later there's this group called Cults. I don't know if you know Cults, out of Brooklyn.
I've heard them, yeah.
Here, just a few minutes. Some things don't change in many ways.
It's very interesting.
It's got those voices at the beginning, and mm-hmm. there's a conversation going on in the background.
And the other thing that both of them share is that very thin female vocal sound,
yep.
where you don't try to give any body to the sound. It's like a very thin silver line in the song.
I start to think about some of the early songs that you would write. And it's hard not to, in retrospect, when I heard that Reparata song, I thought, well,
that's where you got it from.
There's so much there. I mean, I don't know what you thought about when you took yourself into a studio and started writing songs for the first time. These things, as artists, I don't think they're conscious. I assume they weren't conscious for you, but there was an attraction for your enjoyment of that music when you were a kid.
Yes.
And then if I play. I'm just going to play something of yours, unless you have something in mind.
What, from that era, from my early...
I was going to, yeah, I mean, I had I'll Come Running, but it could be anything.
Well, the thing that I think is most informed by that kind of playfulness that's on Reparator and the Delrons is Dead Finks Don't Talk, but I haven't heard it for years. It may be awful, so I don't suggest you should play it necessarily.
Well, let's try, and I'm going to leave your mic open. We can hear you.
Yeah. You can stop it if you don't like it.
You yell stop.
Oh dear, I'm already embarrassed.
You're so perceptive, and I wonder how you knew.
But these things don't walk too well. A bad sense of direction. And so they stumble.
Chicken.
It's from Here Come the Warm Jets. How does it feel to hear that again? And do you like hearing your voice? You like to sing. You have lots of records where that's not at all a part of what you do. We'll talk about your new record coming out in a bit where it's mostly spoken word. What do you think of your voice?
I think my voice is like a pencil. It's sharp and it's precise. And it's not like a brush full of wonderful colour. It's a fine line, but I like pencil drawings, so I'm not embarrassed to be a pencil among singers. I work with a lot of singers who are whole paint sets, and I admire that no end. But one of the things I can do with my voice is I can stack it up so I can make very kind of architectural choruses with it. And the interesting thing about good singers is that they don't make good backing singers, by and large, because their voices are too individually expressive. So they find it hard to do that thing we were talking about earlier of merging into the group. It's not in their nature to do it. Their whole talent is not merging into the group. So I notice this sometimes when in the a cappella evenings, because often friends will drop by, you know, if they happen to be in town, and will be joined by occasionally by an extremely good singer. They find it quite hard to become backing singers. It's just not in their nature, you know, they're colourful, and their colours want to be seen, sort of thing.
Can we talk about a record coming out that's called Drums Between the Bells? Let me play just a little, unless you want to set this up. I was going to play Pour It Out, but we can play anything you want.
Oh, that's a good choice, yeah.
Okay. Do you want to set it up?
I'll talk about it a bit, yes. Yeah. Funnily enough, it's funny I should have chosen Dead Things Don't Talk, because that's one of my earliest examples of spoken word. I've always been interested in spoken word music ever since the late 50s, actually, when there was a record released in England called Red Bird, which was a poet called Christopher Logue reading against a jazz band, essentially. And there was something very compelling about that, I thought, speech against music. And it's always been in my mind that that's one of the options that voices can do. They don't have to be singing all the time. And over the years, this has become more and more part of an ambition of mine to do a record where I just work with spoken voices, but I arrange them in such a way that they become musical. So I can edit the things, move words around, change their pitch, do whatever is necessary to make them sit on the music in a way that is slightly unnatural, slightly too perfect, if you like. Mm-hmm. This particular voice is an Italian woman called Laura Spagnolo, who's the press officer of an NGO that I work with sometimes. And I think her voice is so beautiful. So I said to her one day, "Do you mind reading this, Laura?" And she said, "Of course." And she read it.
So I'm going to play some of it, then you'll come back and tell me who wrote the words. And
yeah. Yes.
Pour it out in new ways. Imaginate. Drop needles like pines into clear pools where molecules are arranged just loose enough to let dreams through. It is weird release to imagine the minuscule where deep sea mollusks can glow orange in tendrils and hemoglobin nodules exist as 20 million models, beautiful as rocks among atomic sea swells, in between kidney-shaped blood cells. Imagine your wildest imaginings. zoom out to macro. Subway hits the sky, and New York hurtles by. New York hurtles by.
It's a beautiful line, New York hurtles by.
It's lovely, isn't it?
Yeah, it really is. Now, she couldn't possibly have spoken those words to that music, right? This music had to either come later or... Well, you tell me.
Well, so first of all, I'll tell you a little bit about the writer of these words.
Thanks.
So I had, as I said, I'd been thinking about making a spoken word record, and then about, 8 years ago now, I saw a young poet called Rick Holland reading some of his work, and it seemed to me exactly the kind of thing I wanted, and the kind of thing that I imagined would work with music. So we started working together, and we didn't really do it very systematically. He doesn't live in London, and when he was in London, he would occasionally drop in, and we would see if I could find something that would fit one of his poems, or I would make something that would fit one of his poems. So it was very casual, went on for quite a long time, several years, and then suddenly we had quite a lot of it. And that's what became this album. What would happen is sometimes the readers, as I said, there's only one person who had any kind of voice training on one of the tracks, unless you include me, but I never had any voice training. So generally I would ask people to read, and I would choose them really by voices that I just found attractive and melodically unusual, which often meant foreign people who spoke English with a foreign accent. Mm-hmm. As soon as you hear someone who isn't English speaking English, you suddenly realize that every language has a melody, and something makes you very aware of that melody when somebody doesn't quite get it right. So you're hearing a mélange between their melody, their natural melody, and the melody of your language. For instance, in the case of Laura here, I took her into the studio and I said, well, this is the piece of music I'm kind of working on, and I just want you to read very, very slowly. I think something interesting happens to language when you break it up so that the words sort of stand alone one after the other, and you have a moment of waiting for the next word and anticipating what it will be. So on quite a few of these pieces, the speech is quite slow and halting deliberately. It's not really intended to flow, if you see what I mean. It's as if this language is like little drops of words that fall into the music.
Are you forming those drops at times by pulling them apart, or was that just the performance?
Generally, what I was saying to people was, I would first of all say, just read it. And they would nearly always read it quite quickly. And then I would say, now try it a bit slower. And now try it a bit slower. And now try it a bit slower. And we would usually do quite a few takes. And I would nearly always take the slowest take, where the language had almost become incoherent, where the structure of the language was on the point of breaking down. I think it was because I didn't want the narrative thread to be the determining object in the music. It's a little bit like if you're painting a scene and there's a person in the scene. If you make the person very big or very highly detailed, then they become the whole subject matter of the picture.
Or so just eyes, for that matter. You put eyes in a photo and in a picture, right?
All your attention goes there. Exactly. So I was trying to find some good balance between landscape, you might say, and the human being in it.
My guest is Brian Eno today. Brian Eno's playing DJ. I've picked a lot of things, and you've picked not quite as many. So why don't you take us to something that you find attractive and you'd like to play?
Okay,
for
so this, my daughter gave me a lift in her little Mini the other month, and she always likes to surprise me with music, and she put this track on, and I loved it so much. I just insisted we kept driving, and we kept listening to this one song again and again. It's Portishead, who've always been a great band, And this is a song called The Rip. And I think what is so fascinating about this is this very contemporary embrace of very primitive electronic technology. You can hear that the stuff they're using is that old kind of late 60s synthesizer that didn't stay in tune and didn't quite work properly. And they've made something so exquisite from this, I think.
Anushka Shankar on as a DJ many years ago, and she picked Portishead, and I remember what she said about that. She remembered walking in a record store, hearing it, and all of a sudden there was a vibe. There was an absolute feeling that overtook the room because of a piece of music. They do that so well, and I think you do that so well. It must be an attraction for you.
Well, thank you very much. I wish I did it as well as them. I just think this is so this is so captivating. I haven't been gripped by a piece of music as much as I was by that for a very long time. I just wanted to tell everyone about it. It was so, I think it's both powerful, energetic, dark, and very, very moving as well. It's very emotional because of the vulnerability of her voice over that kind of churning electronic engine that's underneath her. It's a beautiful piece, I think.
I am totally fascinated by something that you've done, and I'm going to turn on my iPad a moment. I'm going to load up a program called Bloom. Now, as I do that, why don't you tell folks what Bloom is, and I'm going to start to mix in some of Bloom. And tell me, should I hit listen or create? What would you like to help in your illustration? I can do either while I speak.
Try listen.
Okay.
Years and years ago, I sort of identified this form of music that I call generative music, which really grew out of the experiments of Steve Reich and Terry Riley and the California minimalists, I guess you'd say, as well as out of some of the European electronic composers. And it was a kind of music where the composer ceded some of the control and actually created a kind of system which then went on to make music sort of outside of the predictions of the composer. So I was interested in that for theoretical and practical reasons.
I'm trying to think of a like for a non-musician what that means. So if I took wind chimes, for example, and had eight of them and they each could make a tone, That's the system. You hit them harder, they're louder. They ring longer. Right. So that if that helps, and I'm looking now at a screen on an iPad. It could be an iPhone or whatever. But the system here is you've endowed this system with a series of possible notes that will work in keys. Although I'm not sure they're traditional keys, but it will always pretty much sound like this all works, and I can touch the screen if I want to and play the screen with one finger, two fingers, and these beautiful, beautiful, I have to say, just lovely bursts of colored bubbles, I think. That's a terrible description. Come on, as it's playing, they grow and they fade away just as the music does. And this is, you call generative music, and
So I had been doing something like this for several years, but it depended on computers, and it wasn't until a few years ago that suddenly everybody carried a computer in their pocket in the form of their iPhone. And so I worked with a friend of mine called Peter Chilvers, who's a programmer and a musician, and we came up with this piece called Bloom, turned it into an app for the iPhone and now for the iPad. It's been a very successful piece. And
you're not talking about economic success here. In terms of just the way it works, it's so successful.
That's what I mean, yes.
Good.
Everybody seems to understand what it does. It doesn't need a big guidebook or anything like that. And I had the pleasurable experience the other day of ringing up a graphic design company that was doing something for me, and I heard Bloom playing in the office that I was calling, and I said to the receptionist, "Oh, what's that music?" She said, "Oh, I don't know. They're always playing this. It's nice, isn't it?" That was very, very sweet way of hearing your music played and described. Nice, isn't it?
So in some ways, there's music that you play. You play a piano and you're in a room. That's live music. In some ways, there's music that maybe as a listener that I put on. It's music that had been performed that's recorded. And would this fall somewhere in
this
the middle
exactly
of that?
This is exactly halfway. Yes, that's right. This is exactly halfway. So this will never be the same twice. It never plays exactly the same twice. It's kind of interesting. It's a little bit like if there were a piano in the room, you sat down and played it, and then it carried on playing and sort of improvising on what you had just done.
Right. So when are you going to make that one?
We're working on that. It's been a real pleasure doing that Bloom piece, because I've really been thinking about something like this for, well, the first proposal I wrote for something like this was from the late 70s, when I did music for airports, because that sort of uses a similar system, but it was actually a whole system of tape loops, lots of tape loops running together, and they kept colliding with each other in different ways. So it was a piece of music that, in theory, could have been infinitely long, but of course, one couldn't do that in 1978. But Bloom is actually the realization of that idea, because every time anybody uses this piece and this Bloom app, and there may be, you know, several thousand people playing with it right now, they're really sort of instantiating a new version, a unique version of that piece of music. So I'm very keen on the idea of my little piece of music saturating the world in lots and lots of different versions. It appeals to the closet megalomaniac in me.
Do you ever use it for composition yourself?
Well, it is a composition, really.
Yeah,
you see, I see it as a. I don't see it as a tool so much as a piece of music which exists in all of these different forms, most of which I will never ever hear.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, 99.9% of which I will never hear.
Thanks for coming today. Do you want to take us out on something that you're listening to these days?
Sure.
That excites you.
Okay, about a year ago, year and a half ago, a friend of mine who has a club in London, a guy called John Donnelly, rang me up and said, he's Irish, he said, "You got to get over here right away." So he's got very good musical taste. So I jumped in a cab and I went to the club and I heard the last three songs by this young lady called Anna Calvi, three-piece band, her playing fierce guitar. She's an amazing electric guitar player and incredible singer, and a drummer, and another woman who plays squeeze box and shruti and cymbals and has a table full of odd things. And I was completely knocked out by this young woman. I thought she was absolutely amazing. And she made a record, and it's a great record in my opinion. So Anna Calvi is the name of her and her band, and I hope you like this song.
Great, we'll play Suzanne.
By the way, I have no commercial interest in this song. I sound like I'm selling something.
Well, we'll go out on the song Suzanne and I, your new record, which comes out in July. It's called Jumps Between the Bells. Thanks for doing this today, and thank you for all the music. You know, for my life, you've inspired me to become a musician, to do many things. I wouldn't be doing what I do without having heard you, so I thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It's been very nice talking to you.
You be well. Have a good sing.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Brian Eno's new album, Drums Between the Bells, comes out in July. You'll be able to hear the song Pour It Out by going to his website on June 8th. You can hear other artists play DJ, Radiohead's Tom York, Moby, Bjork, and so many more. Find them all by searching our guest DJ at npr.org/allsongs. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.